Welcome to WebRush, the weekly talk show that brings you stories of real-world development from industry experts and developers like you and me. Each week, Ward Bell, Dan Wallin, Craig Shoemaker, and John Papa find out what it takes to write, deploy, and maintain apps that stand up to the demands of the real world. And now, here are your hosts.
Well, hello and welcome back to WebRush. I'm Craig Shoemaker, and today I'm joined by the one and only Dan Wallin and the most amazing and effervescent, yes, you get it this time, Ward Bell. Ward, how you doing?
When did we start this trend of pumping my intro? This is a terrible trend. You know, how about the lackadaisical, know-nothing kind of schlub, Ward Bell?
Yeah, that doesn't apply.
That doesn't apply.
Doesn't work.
Yeah. Anyway,
Craig, I'm a little offended. You did steal the effervescent and applied it to Ward. I mean,
I have to rotate it. You know.
Okay.
You gotta share the love a little bit.
Well, I love Ward a lot, so it's good.
No, you can be effervescent. I'll just be bubbly.
Bubbly.
There we go.
Bubbly. Okay.
Well, today we are going to be talking about GitHub Actions, and we're joined by none other than Lars Brink. If you don't know Lars, Lars is an award-winning author, open source, and open learning maintainer. He works as an open source developer and open source advocate in the European energy industry. Lars, welcome.
Thank you very much, Craig. Nice to meet all of you.
We're really glad to have you in today, and one of the things that you're here to talk to us about is GitHub Actions. That's kind of a broad topic. So maybe you can help orient us a little bit about, you know, first, what is it for people who may not be familiar, and then how you're using it a little bit?
Sure. So GitHub Actions is kind of an umbrella term. It's actually at least two things. Well, you can think of it as kind of a CI and CD provider by GitHub, but it's, of course, it's much more than that once you get to learn all of its features. But it's both what's known as workflows in GitHub and the actual actions of GitHub, which are kind of reusable steps in a workflow job. So there's a bunch of concepts that are involved in GitHub Actions that you can dive deeper into once you start using them.
Why would I care about actions? I use GitHub, you know, pretty regularly, and I'm sure somebody around me has used an action, but I don't. They sound really cool. Like just the word action just makes me get all excited. But what is an action for, and why would I care?
Of course, the simple thing you're going to use them for is doing your CI runs for your open source or proprietary software. But that's really the tip of the iceberg. Actions, GitHub Actions is much more like an event-driven system. They can react to all kinds of events. Most of them are, you get a lot of native events in GitHub, like when someone pushes a commit to a branch, when someone comments in a pull request, or someone opens a pull request, commits to a pull request. So all of those GitHub-y things, all of those can trigger a GitHub workflow, which can then use GitHub Actions to perform some kind of action or magic or whatever. Another thing that's really nice about GitHub Actions is that they have a free license for open source systems. So yeah, you get a pretty good deal if you're running an open source product. And of course, GitHub is today probably the primary place for open source development.
The things that you mentioned are the things that I usually imagine somebody using a webhook to get at. So I must be confusing something.
Yeah, so sure, webhooks is, they also support that, but they do have more of a kind of a declarative syntax. It's a YAML file, so it's kind of configuration. If you've done something like Azure pipelines, it's pretty similar to those. Actually, it has a lot of similarities with Azure pipelines from Azure DevOps. So you kind of specify, for example, on this event, for example, on push, I want to run this workflow whenever something is pushed to, maybe you put a branch filter on there. This workflow only runs on the main branch. and this other workflow, or maybe the same one runs in a pull request, or maybe whenever there's a GitHub release, it will trigger another workflow, which will, I don't know, post something on Twitter about the release.
So, and I'm coding all of this and putting all this, this is my action material. This is actually residing in GitHub as opposed to a webhook, which is, hey, this happened, and then something external wakes up and does it. That's the distinction.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The workflows are in your GitHub repo in a special folder called .github/workflows. And yeah, you can trigger them by a webhook. So that was what I was thinking about. I don't know if, well, of course, you can also use an action to trigger a webhook in some other system. So there's also that direction of things.
So, John, one of the things I like about AG Grid, which is a data grid component for the kind of complex grid scenarios that we encounter all the time in enterprise apps, one of the things I really like about it is that it works for a variety of frameworks, Angular, React, Vue, or just vanilla JS. Does that ring a bell for you?
Oh, it really does. There's all these different companies that I work with where they have no choice but to use a lot of these different tools because they have different teams working on them. So being able to port their code or share that code and that technical investment they have is really important to them.
Yeah, well, it's important to us. Ideally, we're a consulting company, and you know, we never know what our client's going to want to use, Angular, React, or Vue, but they're all going to need a grid, and it's great to be able to reach for the one grid that works everywhere, AG Grid.
You know, at any size company, too, because you could have these teams that maybe they only use one framework, but eventually they're going to switch to another one and be able to take that investment again and use it, reuse it, is really nice.
So if a multi-framework data grid makes sense to you, please go check out AG Grid at ag-grid.com.
So if you were to take your example of, okay, we have a new version release, there's an action that runs and we want to post on Twitter, and I know this probably isn't something you would necessarily use it for, but how would you glue that together? Are you calling into different services? Are you writing code to make that happen? How does that work?
So there's kind of a first party actions by the GitHub teams. Those are at github.com/actions. But of course, there's also the GitHub marketplace where it has, I believe, more than 12,000 actions listed. And then, of course, we can create our own and we can have them locally in the repo, or we can share them in a GitHub organization in a special repo called .github. That's kind of one of the things I really like about the GitHub actions, is that they make a lot of sense to me when I want to create them myself. I've worked with many different CI and CD providers, and they're not that easy to like start learning how to do one yourself. Maybe it's because GitHub Actions are kind of, there's kind of three types, and one of them is you can code them in Node.js, but then another one is if all your action is doing is accepting parameters and passing them on to other actions, then you can configure it without any code, like any programming language code. So it's all in a single configuration. So that's also nice. You can actually do a lot of good stuff with that, or you can extract your logic that's used across different jobs into one action so that you only have to change it once if you want to rework how that part of your flow works. And the third type of actions is actually container actions, as in OCI or Docker containers, which means that you can use any programming language because you can wrap an entire environment in that Docker file and then hook that into your action. So that makes it very approachable for most programmers to write your own action. And that's where some of the power comes from.
What you mentioned YAML, Node, you know, Docker. What core skills do you think are most valuable for people if they do want to get started with GitHub Actions?
Well, you can, as I mentioned, you can use any programming language. There's kind of, some are better than others in that there will be an SDK available from GitHub to perform common tasks in the context of a GitHub action. Of course, there's one for Node.js. There's also, I believe there's also some for other programming languages. I can't list them right now. But even if there is no SDK for your programming language, what you really need to do the basic things with actions is you need to accept input. And you do that through environment variables. So you can access that from most programming languages, I guess. And to give output, so any output value that can be used in the workflow using your action, you call a special terminal command. So just output something to the standard out pipe, and you're good. So those are kind of the only two requirements for basic action stuff. And other than that, well, you need to perform some kind of side effect, because that's what the actions are useful for, like generating a report or downloading some data, or uploading some data, or something like that.
So you mentioned like terminal. Do I need to be like a Linux guru at all, or know any of those key commands, or is that not really a requirement?
That would be a useful skill, because then you can use what's called a composite action, where you don't write any programming language code. You can write things in Bash or even in PowerShell. I believe those are supported native in GitHub Actions. So in that way, your whole action is encapsulated in that one YAML file. So you have terminal commands as different steps in that action. So yeah, you can do a lot of things. If you're powerful with PowerShell or Bash or something like that, you can do a lot of good things, and you don't have to be, maybe you're not kind of a software developer. Maybe you're more of a like a shell guru or whatever. I don't know what's the term for that. Like maybe you're doing a lot of DevOps thingy and like system administrative stuff, taking care of your infrastructure. So maybe the command line is where you do most of your work, and GitHub Actions is also pretty good for that.
So when you're in the situation where you're building your own custom action, you're saying that environment variables are available. What kind of data is passed in? Like, what do you have access to? Are there lifecycle events that you can respond to? Like, what's sort of the programming API available?
So you, as part of your action configuration or declaration, you name which input parameters can be passed to your action, and you can give them a type, say a string or a number. You can configure or declare whether they are required. And if they're optional, you can also pass in a default value. And you can give them a name and a description. Those are kind of the properties you can give to inputs. And you can do kind of a similar thing for your output properties. You can declare the name of an output value that the consumers of your action can expect to read after your action has done its business. So if you call an action, what you will see in github.com, if you're in the actions tab in your repository, that's where the workflows are triggered and you get all the logs. So your action will be, I believe it'll be one step in your workflow. And it will have kind of a console output window. There will be some setup. There can be some like pre and post hooks for setting up the environment and tearing it down, whatever is needed for your action. And then you can log what's going on if you want to keep the user informed of what's going on right now, right? So you get log messages with timestamps. If you do that inside of your action, the user will be able to see that as part of their workflows.
So how did you get into this, Lars? I mean, do you come at it as a developer who had to deal with DevOps, or how did you stumble into this whole world, and how did it become important to you?
Yeah, a few different things keep me coming back to GitHub Actions. Initially, it was part of an Angular library, actually, called Lumberjack. It's a plugin-based logging library specifically for Angular applications and libraries. We wanted to verify which major and minor versions of the Angular frameworks were compatible with our one major version of our library. And to do that, we created a custom GitHub action, published it on the marketplace. That's kind of a, like, set up your repo for version X of Angular. So basically, it's modifying the package JSON. So where we specify our package dependencies from NPM, that's in the JavaScript ecosystem, right? So we created an action for that and then used that as part of our library using our GitHub workflow. So every time we do a commit, it's passing through 50 different variations of an Angular version, an RxJS version, a TypeScript version, and a Node.js version. So we have a huge, what's called a matrix of different combinations of dependencies so that we get kind of a verified status of are these versions actually supported by our one version of the library, which means that we can almost guarantee that it will work in your application across all these different, like, I believe we support 15 major and minor versions of Angular and 3 different major versions of Node. And it also means we can patch and release features across all these 15 versions of Angular in one major version of the library. That's also pretty powerful, especially when you're plugin-based and you want to make it easy for your community of plugins so that they don't have to take into account what versions of Angular do we support and which version of Lumberjack do we support and so on. So that was kind of an interesting experience. That was about a year and a half ago we started doing that.
That's pretty compelling because, yeah, it sounds like otherwise that's just a massive headache to do manually.
And especially, like, if we have to pay for that, we would not be doing it that way. But since we're an open source library, we're getting that for free from GitHub. You get something like, if you're using Ubuntu Linux images for your GitHub runners, you can do, I think it's 20 or 30 parallel jobs at the same time for free. And they're fast enough for most use cases. It's running on a certain Azure image, and it's fast enough for most of the things we do.
If we circle back, you mentioned, I don't remember the official term, but a GitHub Actions kind of marketplace, if you will. Is that a good way to go if you need, you know, say I'm new to this. So for me, I've used GitHub Actions, not to the extent you're mentioning by any means. But for mine, it's mostly been like I'll use Azure Static Web Apps, for example. It'll create, you know, a GitHub Actions YAML file, and then I just tweak it. So, you know, I can put 10 years of experience GitHub Actions because I've tweaked a YAML file, right, on my resume. we were joking about that before we started the podcast. What can I do, though? If I, like, let's say that, for instance, I use static web apps and it creates this, but then I need to do X, Y, and Z as side effects, for example, or outputs or whatever. Is that marketplace a good way to, or what's the term there? Is it marketplace or what do they call it? Just GitHub Actions?
It's called the GitHub Marketplace, and you can find actions there that you can use in your own workflows. You can also find what's called GitHub apps. And that's kind of a separate thing. You can activate them on one repo at a time, and they are systems that live outside of GitHub, but they hook into some events in GitHub. So, and they can do things like, if you know Sonar Source, they have the product called Sonar Cloud. So there's a Sonar Cloud app to connect your GitHub repo to the Sonar Cloud service. So it'll report back in your pull request the results of running Sonar Cloud on your branch for different kinds of code quality checks. So that's one example of the GitHub app. So that's a separate concept. And I think it even came before GitHub Actions and workflows.
Are the actions a good place for people to get started if they're new to it?
Definitely, especially since some of the most common ones are actively maintained by GitHub. And that would be, there's an action for checking out the source code. like of your repo. That's not in the GitHub runner by default. In some CI/CD providers, it'll check out the code into your workflow or pipeline, whatever you want to call it. But here you have to do it yourself, and you do that by using an action. Well, you could also do like a git terminal command. That'll work as well, but here it's wrapped in an action with different optimizations and parameters like other actions have. And other common ones are like setup.net, so specify which version of .NET or Python or Node.js you want to have available in the context of this one job in this workflow. So, and other than that, go search the marketplace. Like, what do we want to do? I want to create a release on GitHub. Okay, there's probably an action for that. I know there is. For most things, there's probably something, at least one action out there. There's 12,000 of them after a few years. Those are pretty good numbers. And if nothing else, like if you don't find one that does exactly what you want, well, they're all open source. Like when you reference an action, you are actually referencing a GitHub repository, a public one, usually. Unless it's your own actions, then you might have them in your private repo, but then your other repos might also be able to access them, or it's part of the repo itself, right? But anyways, most of the actions you're using are in public GitHub repos. So if I have an action called actions/checkout, I can find that at github.com/actions/checkout. And there will be an action.yaml file, which is actually what's being triggered in my workflow. So that's also a pretty interesting programming model.
So where is the action in actions actually happening? I was hoping to get another A word in there to finish my alliteration, but
that was pretty good though, Craig.
Where is it happening? So it's happening either as a hosted GitHub runner, which sits somewhere in Azure. GitHub is owned by Microsoft, right? They're using Azure for these services. Or you can do a self-hosted GitHub runner. For example, say you want to deploy something to your environment, but you don't want to add all the public GitHub runner IPs to your internal firewall. So you can create a self-hosted GitHub runner and kind of ask for that in your deployment workflow. And that self-hosted runner is a Docker image provided by GitHub, and you spin it up in your environment and you kind of register it with GitHub so that your workflows can ask for access to that runner, and then it's inside of your network, right?
Gotcha. Okay. And so I don't expect you to like have all this memorized off the top of your head or anything, but inside the GitHub runner, do you know like how much memory do you have available? How much compute resources are available? Like, is it like enough that you don't usually need to worry about it type of a situation?
So the hosted runners, the one provided by GitHub, I mean, the free OSS version you're getting, or anytime you do a public repo, I think even in the private repos, you're also getting something like 3,000 minutes a month for free. Those are running on, I don't remember the actual name of that Azure image, but it's two vCPUs, so two virtual cores, and about, it's at least 6 gigabytes of RAM. And I don't know how much disk space, maybe, I don't know, maybe 60 gigabytes or something. I don't know for sure. But anyway, that's enough for most of the things we're doing.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, I mean, we were running, we had these 50 kind of jobs or variations of the same jobs that had to run as fast as possible. We were able to do that within a few minutes on a free tier, right?
Wow.
Because we're open source. So it's fast enough for most use cases.
Hey, John, I have this great idea for a mobile app. I want to use native features like the camera, photo gallery, and geolocation. But I just don't have the time to learn a new language like Swift.
Yeah, but you do know JavaScript and web tech like React, Angular, and Vue, right?
I do, but how does that help me?
Well, if you use the Ionic framework, you can use your JavaScript skills and you get fully styled iOS and Android mobile components. Plus, it uses a capacitor to talk to all the native device platforms.
So if I use Ionic and capacitor, I don't have to learn a new language. My JavaScript skills give me what I need to build a cross-platform app.
Absolutely. And you can check it out at ionic.link/webrush.
I'll do it. So you've talked about a couple different scenarios that work for you and the applications that you run. And I know the marketplace has lots of ideas and examples, but like, what are some of the most common things that you see people using an action for?
Common things, definitely like a CI, like building, running unit tests, running lint checks, things like that. And then deploying your application to your environment. And for example, so GitHub doesn't have its own cloud, except for maybe GitHub Pages, where you can host your website from a GitHub repo. So, but then you need actions for the different clouds. So there are actions for Azure. So for example, there's probably some for AWS. There's probably some for Google Cloud. So hopefully there's an action you can use to deploy to those cloud environments. And if not, well, maybe they have a CLI and you can install that in your workflow runner as part of your steps in your jobs. So those are kind of the common things, right? But that's more of a traditional CI/CD. Other common things, well, many open source projects are on GitHub. So other common things would be published to a package registry and maybe at the same time create what's called a GitHub release. So it shows up in your repository. Maybe there's release notes. There's an asset attached with that binary or package version of your software package. Those are some of the more common things, I believe. Would you like to learn about some more uncommon things?
I wanted to hear the strangest thing you ever saw as an action. because that's where I go. My head goes like, you know, what are they doing to baby seals or something like that?
I read yesterday that there's a GitHub team. They are taking images of the team, I don't know, in meetings or something. And they have an action that takes those images or photos and turn them into a GIF or a GIF, however you want to pronounce that, and uploads it to their repo. So that's kind of a funny thing, right?
I always thought you were going to say they're going to roll them into an NFT and then we could all sell it.
Yeah, that would be great. Mint a coin for every release, or I don't know.
Every release should have its own NFT. Yeah, why not? And who doesn't want, you know, to spend their trade a particular commit?
But the sad thing is those CI/CD providers like GitHub, like Azure, DevOps, one of the issues is that people keep abusing them for, say, crypto mining or machine learning training or something. Like, here, I have 3 minutes here. I can, or maybe I can use someone else's minutes by submitting a pull request and tricking them into running my code. So that's a big issue and kind of cost. At least at some point, Azure DevOps to roll back or retire the public repo gets 3 minutes. I believe they are back again, but they were totally removed at some point because of this issue. And I don't know how GitHub addressed that, but it's certainly something all the CI providers have to face at some point, or many times, really. So that's a sad part of it. So what else is there funny things? One of you said you probably don't want to tweet about your release. Well, I have a nonprofit organization called This Is Learning, and a few of the things we have are publications on dev.2, the dev community page. We have, I don't know, 40 or 50 writers publishing with us. And anyone else can join as well. Just reach out to me or Santosh Yadav, who's also been on this show. And every time people publish with us, we have a GitHub action that is being triggered by the RSS feed on dev community, and it goes and tweets about the article and tweets the name of the author, tags it with the tags the article has, and posts the link, of course. Because I was doing that manually when I started the publication, but as soon as you have 30 people, it becomes a lot of work, and that's where developers get lazy and we look for automation, right? And to the point that this bot that is tweeting for us is open sourced, and one of our writers and community members created that tweeting action or the tweeting workflow for us.
You mentioned getting lazy, which in reality you mean being productive, of course. But
exactly.
It's funny how we as developers, we are really good at, quote, getting lazy, meaning that we find ways to automate various processes. If there's one group on this planet that does that well, I think it's us. But it's kind of the fun part of the job, you know, as well. So that's cool you're doing that. Probably took a big load off your shoulders, I would guess.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Like all those tedious tasks, like you're thinking, I'm doing the same thing all over every day. There must be some way to automate this. And GitHub Action is one way to do that. Maybe you know something like Zapier, whatever it's called. So imagine you could do that with GitHub Actions. Turns out you can. There's an open source project called Actions Flow that adds several triggers that are not in GitHub workflows themselves. So for example, there's an RSS trigger, and that's what we used here, so that we hook into an RSS feed, and every time there's a new item added to that RSS feed, an action is triggered, and that action then tweets to our account. So we have secret linking it to our Twitter account. There's other triggers, like you published a package on NPM, some message was sent in your Slack channel, things like that, or someone tweeted about something and you want that to trigger an action. So there's crazy things like that, or the weather is good today, let's do something.
This confuses me a little bit, Lars, because I imagined that actions were triggered by something that happened in GitHub itself. But you're saying, no, I can listen to anything that's, I mean, how can I be listening to an RSS feed? You started there, when that has nothing to do with GitHub.
Right. And yes, as I said, there are some triggers built into GitHub workflows, and many of them are about events that happen on GitHub. But then there's this open source project called Actions Flow, and you can use it in your GitHub repo. I have to say that GitHub doesn't want you to use this like all the time. Like,
if it was just listening to Twitter and listening to Instagram and and all these other things and firing off, that's like, what does this have to do with GitHub? That I would think they would be opposed to that.
So use it sparingly if you're using it directly on GitHub under runners, and alternatively, you could run it in another place. You can run the Actions Flow service so that you're paying for the compute minutes in whatever cloud provider or on-premise servers you have yourself. Then you can like make it go and check every minute if it should trigger your workflow, your Actions Flow workflow. So that adds some other triggers in that way, and you can code some yourself as well.
So let me see if I understand that right. Rather than make GitHub be listening to nonstop Twitter, I could fire up my own little bot server, something like that was listening, filtering for things that I wanted to do. And then from there, whenever I saw something, I'm using my compute time over there. And then when I see something that really wants to make an action, I shoot over to GitHub and trigger my action through some API directly. Is that your idea?
Yes, that is it. And if you don't have your own server, you can use it on GitHub workflows, but then like you should only run it maybe a few times per day like we do. And we have people publishing maybe every day or so. So that works for us. And it's used like hopefully not in a harmful way. There's one caveat.
Do they have a governance mechanism? Are they like watching and shutting people down and stuff?
So there's one caveat here. That is, if there's no activity in your repository, then your workflows kind of shut down in GitHub. And because we're doing this in a repo that doesn't get commits all the time, then it does shut down that RSS workflow every 60 days or something like that. And we have to manually turn it on again. So to get around that in the proper way, we would have to set up a server somewhere else and then hook it into this GitHub workflow.
Yeah, something that woke up on a timer. Yeah.
So Lars, I've heard of this thing called GitOps. Very recently, actually heard about it. Can you tell us more about what that is and how you're involved
there? Ops, Dan? It's Git-Ops?
I guess. Yeah.
Well, you got to throw ops on the end of everything. So Lars, giddy up. Ha ha.
Yeah. So GitOps is kind of, you can think of it as automated DevOps plus Git. So the kind of the core concept there is, your Git repository is the source of truth for your environments and their configuration and their state. So if you want a change in your cloud or on-premise environment, you commit something to your Git repo. So there's a description of which services are running, which versions are they running, which environment variables do they have. And you might have that in the same repository as your application, or oftentimes you have something that might be called an environment repository. So that's what's describing the environment that your applications are running in. And to kind of give you an idea about what's happening there. So usually you might, for example, publish your application as a Docker image or a NuGet package, if it's .NET, or an NPM package, or maybe even just an asset bundle to a GitHub release. And then after releasing that, and maybe you automate all of this, or maybe you do it manually, right? But then you go to your environment repo or wherever your environment is described in your in a Git repository, and you say, now you should be running version 1.2 of my application in this environment. And maybe you have several environments described. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah. And I see there's a link. It's in the GitLab, right? Is this something you're using yourself, or is it something you wrote, or how does this?
A company called Weaveworks kind of coined this term 5 years ago or so. So, and it's the new hotness. So many people
we're
are
all
writing
about the new hotness here.
Yeah, many people are writing about it. My team happens to be doing it in practice this past half year. So, and to do that, we created a lot of custom GitHub workflows and GitHub actions, actually, because it's like some solutions. You get some of this as a package, as a kind of a turnkey solutions, or at least you get elements of GitOps. For example, you mentioned Dan, Azure, what's it called, static web apps or something like that. They have kind of this GitOps thingy, because one of the things you usually have is the ability to create environments on demand, temporary environments, preview environments, feature environments, whatever you want to call them. And that's one of the things that Azure Static Web Apps gives you when you create a pull request. They set up an environment and send you a link in your pull request. Here's your preview environment. That's actually one of the ideas in GitOps and one of the capabilities we have in my team. We have one environment only that's continuously running. That's the production environment. And then as part of developing new features, we spin up a new environment. And the way we do that is we create a branch in our environment repository, then kind of as close as possible to a clone of the production environment is created. We use Azure Kubernetes service, and then a lot of Kubernetes cloud native things on top of that. So a new Azure resource group, a new Azure Kubernetes cluster is spun up when we create a branch in this repository, and then it runs the same versions as we do in production. And then we have automation from our application repositories that goes every time we create a commit to a pull request, it does a pre-release of that application. It publishes it to GitHub Container Registry. That's a Docker image registry in GitHub. And then it goes to our environment repo and says, now you run this pre-release version in the preview environment. So we get a fresh environment within 15 minutes or so, completely isolated from everything else. And we run a copy of production, but with this one version, or maybe we want to run pre-release versions of two different services in this same temporary environment. So that's the way we integrate before then merging to main, because then it goes straight into production automatically.
So when you say it goes straight into production, it's working kind of like slots work, where you're going to point traffic to that instance, or you're just going to take the changes that you've now verified and then apply it to the main branch?
After we've integrated the features together and tested them automatically and some manual tests as well, and then we merge our pull requests, and that will do not a pre-release, but a release version on the GitHub Container Registry. We also have Helm charts on top of that. And then finally, also automated, it goes into the environment repo and says, in the main branch, now the production environment should run this new released version of the package. And that, then you have a what's known as a GitOps operator that connects it to some other, usually some other provider we're using. There's two big ones that are used together with Kubernetes. One is Flux and one is Argo CD. We're using Argo CD. And kind of the gist of it is it continuously looks at our environment repo, and when it notices a change, it will try to apply that change to the Kubernetes cluster it's managing. So that's how it works. A commit is pushed to the main branch, which describes the production environment we have. And then Argo CD picks it up and says, okay, let me try to deploy that new version. And if that's successful, it will, I don't know, you're probably familiar with Kubernetes. Then the new version is stable, so the old pods are kind of torn down once the new ones are.
Yeah, has the new version zero downtime deployment. Yeah. Right.
So that's kind of the gist of it. And all of those steps are automated using GitHub workflows and actions. And we as a team were able to do all of that. We're able to take the developer experience we were aiming at and implement it on our own. Of course, we're not perfect. We're improving it all the time. There are edge cases, and we were able to fix that. So that's a pretty good testimony to the power of GitHub Actions.
What you've described is like very non-trivial. Like a lot is going on there, and that's great that your team has been able to implement all that with all the tools that are available. Well, Lars, thanks so much for sharing all this great information with us. Usually around the end of the show, we like to share some final thoughts. So let me just kind of go around the room here for a minute and see what our awesome co-hosts here have brought for us this week. Dan, what about you?
I think this is one of those subjects that some folks listening probably have done it. I've done, again, enough to be dangerous, I guess you could say, but like I wish, Lars, we could hang out. I'd love to see this whole, like, how you do this. I'd learn a lot from you, it sounds like. But I want to kind of go back to, you got to start somewhere. And like, I have two processes as we were talking, and I'm like, you know, I really should make time to automate these, because they're not super hard to run on my own, but it's like, why? Why even run it on my own? Why not have a more official automated process? Because if I run it, there's more human error. So I guess it got me thinking, though, like, what would I have to do? Because one of them, the second one, is actually a little more involved with containers, Lars, and tagging, as you know, tagging the containers and stuff like that. So it got me thinking, you know, don't let some of these subjects, if you're new to this, overwhelm you. Start with the most simple thing, get something working, and then go from there. Because that's usually how I start out, is getting like, oh my gosh, this is so overwhelming. I don't know if I can even, like, forget it. I'm just not going to do it, you know? Versus if I would have taken more of like the, okay, I'm just going to add flour and water and try to cook that first. See how that, you know, it's probably going to be too tasty, but hey, at least I can cook it and then move on. I think it makes it a lot more digestible and easy. And that's probably what I'd say for something like this. So that's my thought.
Nice. What kind of cooking tips do you have for us today, Ward?
Well, I'm afraid to turn
flour and water, Ward.
I'm afraid to even turn on the stove here, because this whole, you know, I'm the guy that knows nothing about deployment, yeah, except I know how to complain about all the deployments that have broken. That's my strength. That's my superpower. I'm a really good complainer. I, you know, in the process of complaining, which I do a lot of, I see a lot of practices that are so far from what you're describing. And I wonder, why can't they do this? Why aren't more people doing this? So it's not something it's something I'm afraid to learn, because then I'll end, you know, who knows where that would take me. But I sure do want what it does is encourages me to go to the people who keep making the same mistakes over and over again with their manual stuff and say, hey, you know, looks to me like there's a better world out there. And I'm going to point them to this episode so they get the instinct.
That's awesome. So we're talking about learning new stuff and building up new disciplines, and it's just a lot of hard work. I saw this guy tweeting, no one's going to confuse me for anyone muscular. Like, that's just not even in the cards. I saw this guy tweeting about working out and building muscle and all that kind of stuff. And I read his thread, and he was basically outlining essentially a system for trying something new, or you know, in the context of what he was doing was being physically fit. But as I was reading it, I was realizing all the principles that he laid out in this thread really apply to learning anything new. And I'm sure this is probably the theme of some book somewhere or something like that. But the main thing that he said was just really focus on why you want to learn something. You know, in this context, if we're taking out manual processes and we're creating something that brings a lot of benefit to the deployment aspect of our applications, like honing in on that and then starting with Dan's, you know, step-by-step process can really help make a lot of sense to something that really does feel like a lot. So I'll put a link in the show notes to that tweet, and you can check it out and see what you think.
Hey, but if nothing else, I might build some muscle, huh?
There you go. We'll have to do it together.
Not happening.
So, Lars, what can you leave us with here right at the end?
I want to point the audience to a few useful resources related to these topics. We already mentioned the Azure Static Web Apps. Those will work if you're on GitHub or on Azure DevOps. If all you need is a single page application and a web API, you can do that with Azure functions that are triggered by HTTP. If that's all you need, then Azure Static Web Apps is your friend, and you can get some of the things from GitOps principles out of the box. So, like, you don't have to do anything almost. Another cool tool also by Microsoft is called, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but Noobs Gen. It's NUBESGEN.com. And that's kind of a click a few times and you get a like a GitOps light setup generated for in GitHub workflows. And so it's kind of, you want something running in Azure. Maybe you want an Azure app service. Maybe you want an Azure function. Maybe you want a MongoDB document store to go with that, or Postgres or SQL Server, and a few other options. So you click through like a wizard, and at the end, you can also check a box that says GitOps, and you click generate or download or something like that, and you get a zip package with GitHub workflow and either Terraform modules or Bicep templates describing these Azure services. So that's a really nice way to get started exploring some of this. You can get up and running really quickly. So those are two very good resources for this. If you want to learn more about GitHub Actions, implementing them, using them, GitHub has this place called GitHub Learning Lab. And they have courses, three courses or so at least, around focusing on GitHub Actions. And the way you learn them is you have a bot that guides you through opening pull requests and committing changes in a repo you create yourself. So the bot will comment in your pull request, giving you instructions on what to do next and verifying your changes. That's also quite a fun way to learn. It's almost like a Clippy in GitHub. So those are some of the resources I will recommend.
Thank you. So Noobs Gen, Dan, were you familiar with that at all?
Yeah, actually, Julian in the overall cloud advocacy group I'm part of drives all that. I know there's other folks involved. I don't know them, but I'll give a shout out to him real quick because, nice. He's the one that kind of dreamt that up.
That's awesome. Well, and again, all the resources that we talked about, the links are all available in the show notes. Lars, thanks so much for joining us today. I know I learned a lot. It's been really helpful. I hope people listening. And of course, thank you for listening to us and joining us here every week. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you soon. Our sponsors, AG Grid, Narwhal, of course, IdeaBlade, and Ionic Framework,